Good afternoon, evening, morning, whatever time it is where you are. This is Tom Harris. Welcome to Tom Harris USA, episode number 26. It's a beautiful Chicago afternoon here. It's warm, but not too hot. And it's sunny, but not too sunny. And then I've been running around all day doing errands and so forth, getting in preparation for my upcoming vacation. And that's just, you know, a couple weeks away now. So I'm getting kind of excited about it now. And I talked about that last time. But I went and got my hair cut. And that's kind of one of those things I don't do very often. I usually get it cut really short and then wait, you know, 6 months and have it cut again. But it was getting rather shaggy, so yep, I've gone to have it cut. So today we're going to talk about creationism and science. And I'm going to go over some of this stuff is going to be a little bit technical. I think it's really important to be on the same page, especially when you're talking about terminology. Because when you have terms that can mean more than one thing, I think we just need to get on the same page of what those terms are going to mean in the context of this conversation. But before I start on the technical discussion here, I do have a couple comments I'd like to read. And I'm going to go ahead and read those at the beginning of the show, because I'm not sure if I'm going to have time at the end. So here we go. The first comment is from Irving Distiller, and this is on Facebook. And Irving says, I am enjoying your episode number 25 podcast. Listening to another person wallowing in a sea of indecision is rather comforting. Well, I'm happy that my pain is giving you amusement, Irving. What Irving's talking about is last time I was talking about my upcoming trip to the UK, and I have 3 days at the end of the trip that I'm not really sure what to do with. And I've been thinking about maybe going out to the Isle of Islay. Still not really sure about this yet. And the reason why is because I'm not sure I have enough time. Because certainly I could get out to Islay on the 26th and maybe stay there the 27th, 28th, and then back to London on the 29th. But I don't know. You know, is 2 days long enough to be in Islay? I don't know. It's a big island, and I would really like to spend more time than that. But maybe I could still go and get a taste of it and then kind of get an idea about whether I'd like to go back. So we'll see. Right now I'm kind of leaning towards going to Islay. Anyway, Irving continues. Perhaps you could squeeze in a quick stop at Norwich to visit Ross Patzelt and DonnaCarter.com, and you would have the opportunity to play snooker at Ross's favorite pub. Well, that sounds like a great idea, actually. I wouldn't mind doing that. I'm not really going to be on that side of the country, but what I was thinking, now, some time ago on Chris Reardon's show, he was talking about how he would like to go and meet up with them. And for some reason, Ross doesn't want to. So maybe what I should do is now, don't tell Ross or Donna this, but I think what we're going to do is I'm going to get Chris Reardon, and we're going to drive to their house and force them to make us lasagna. I think that sounds really good. I actually was in Norwich back in 96. I did a couple months in the UK, and Norwich was one of the places that I visited during that time because I knew somebody who lived there. And the only thing I remember about Norwich is the Mustard Museum, which I occasionally make fun of. Though I thought it was really interesting at the time, and I love mustard. The Norman Castle there, which is kind of this big, ugly, blocky thing, but they've kind of turned it into a museum inside. And so that's pretty good. I mean, yeah. But Norwich isn't the most exciting place in the world. They have a Tesco's there, too, I hear. Playing snooker sounds good. I haven't played very much, but I have played a few times, and whenever I go to the UK, I'm always very interested in playing it. But it's hard to find anywhere in America that actually has a snooker table. And that's tough because the snooker table is huge. It's a big piece of furniture. You think of the pool tables that you see in a bar here in the States. A snooker table is, you know, three times that size. And it still only has six pockets. So it takes a lot more skill if you have the full-size table. And the pockets are also narrower. It's harder to get the balls in the pockets. So it is actually a game that requires a lot of skill. and it's just one I just think it's a fascinating game, and I really wish that more people would play it here. But it, you know, I've been to, you know, in Cleveland and in Chicago both, looking for a like a billiards club or something that would actually have a snooker table, and it's just impossible to find here. So I don't know. I don't think I'm going to be going to Norwich, but we'll see. And I have a second comment here. This is through email. And this is from Joe Morris at AmericanTalkUSA.com, a fellow podcaster. He publishes a new show every Wednesday at AmericanTalkUSA.com. And Joe had this to say. I was talking about doing other people's podcasts, kind of switching around. Joe says, regarding your suggestion about hosting each other's shows as the originating host does it, I could never tell a story as good as you or Chris. Oh, you flatter me, sir. You flatter me. My mind drifts far too quickly off kilter. Also, Chris is a master at reading and integrating his commentary inside the text of a listener email. Oh, yeah, he certainly does that. And then there's Ross, who does a great job at the live show format. And that's not the easiest thing to pull off. Well, no, Joe hits the nail right on the head here. Perhaps we should just let Irving do all of our shows, and whomever is the last out, just flip off the lights and lock the deadbolt. Cheers, Joe at Joe's American Talk USA. Yeah, I think it's a great idea. Just to have Irving can do all of our shows, and then we can call him in the way he does with everyone else's show. So then everybody would get to enjoy my tinny voice over the airwaves as I call in onto Irving's show. That actually kind of reminds me, and I kind of been wondering about this. Okay, so everyone probably knows by now that I call Ross Patzelt's show on Monday mornings. And I've noticed that when I call other people's shows, that my voice sounds different. Now, I don't really have any adjustments on the headset that I can make to make my voice sound differently over Skype. And Skype doesn't seem to have any adjustments either, not that I've been able to find. Now, I do slightly tweak the bass on my voice when I do my show. But basically, it is how you hear it. There really isn't that much change. Sometimes I have to clean up some noise because I live in an apartment building, and you know, sometimes you get noise from the courtyard and things. But it's weird, and I've been kind of wondering why my voice is so tinny when I appear on Ross's show. Anyway, if any more technically minded people out there can give me some advice on that, I'd appreciate that. Maybe I just need to get a professional mic. I mean, I'm using a Logitech headset mic, and it's served me pretty well so far, but yeah, I kind of wonder. So now it's time to change gears, and I'm going to be changing gears drastically here. And I'm going to talk a bit about creationism and science, because they're not the same thing. And this is kind of what's come out of the reading and so forth and the research that I've been doing on Noah. And I intended just to kind of do one show on Noah, and then that would kind of be the end of that. Well, what's happened is I found that you can't really do that. It's all kind of interconnected. The first thing I want to do is talk a little bit about science and religion. Religion is dogmatic. It's not very adaptable. It's not falsifiable. And it requires faith. And I'll kind of go down these one by one. What I mean by dogmatic means there are certain teachings that you are expected to accept in order to be a good whatever it is you are. Now, when I say religion in this case, I am going to be speaking mostly of Christianity. And I do apologize that I'm not being a little bit more widespread in what I'm talking about. But Christianity is the culture that I grew up in. And I was, you know, kind of nominally a Christian when I was a kid, and then as a teenager, became born again and was very, very active in that for a number of years. So yes, I am kind of talking about Christianity in particular, though you can actually adapt this to the other major religions as well. Anyway, religion is dogmatic, like I said. There's certain teachings that you need to accept. B, religion is not very adaptable. So meaning if you deviate from the dogma of your belief or your church, you could end up in a major disagreement with them, and you could have some real problems there. C, religion is not falsifiable. You can't disprove the existence of God. And the reason why you can't disprove the existence of God is because there's no evidence to support the existence of God. So it leads me to point four, that religion is a matter of faith. Believing in things for which there is no evidence requires faith. And when you come right down to, well, prove that God doesn't exist, you know, you're actually kind of stuck because you can't prove a negative. And that's where it comes down to a lot in various discussions that I've had with Christians over the years. But the fact that you need to have faith to believe it tells you that it's not science. Now, one of the criticisms that's frequently brought up against scientists, and in particular when we're talking about evolution, because this is kind of tied in, is that religious people like to claim that it takes as much faith to believe in evolution as it does to believe in God. And that's actually the opposite of the truth. I'm not going to call that a lie, because I don't think that they're lying purposely, necessarily. I think it's just a matter of ignorance. But so let's go, kind of talk about the four attributes of science. Science is not dogmatic. There's no beliefs that you need to have to be a scientist. Science involves gathering data, as much data as possible, whether it be, you know, millions of fossils or whatever, and figuring out, you know, based on the data, which is, you know, the type of fossil it is, how old it is, and you tell that from the strata where it's found, mostly, and determining what your conclusions are from studying the data. It's the opposite of dogmatic, because the data can change, which leads us to point B. It adapts to changes constantly. Science is always changing. Back when I was a kid, you know, people used to think that dinosaurs stood straight upright. They're talking about things like allosaurs and tyrannosaurus. You know, they would sit straight upright, and they drag their tails along the ground. Well, nobody believes that anymore. And the reason why nobody believes that anymore is because the data has changed. As we've discovered more fossils, we've been able to determine that they stood somewhat differently now. The data constantly changes because new discoveries are being made all the time. Point C, science is falsifiable and testable. Which means if you have a particular hypothesis, you can disprove it. It's not a matter of making stuff up. People don't make stuff up in science. You just can't do that. You come up with an idea, and that's a hypothesis, and that's not data. And the adaptability of science and the falsifiability of science has created this thing called the scientific method. And the scientific method is the way in which scientists study the data and come to the conclusions they come to. Science doesn't require faith. So when a Christian tells you it takes just as much faith to believe in evolution as it does to believe in God, then you say, no, that's just flat wrong. Because there is no evidence that a God exists, but there's a lot of evidence that evolution exists. And there's a huge, huge, huge difference there. Okay, so I'm going to move on for a second. I'm going to talk a little bit about what a theory is and how that's different from a fact and a hypothesis. We'll come back to the other stuff in a bit. It's very important to note that there's a big difference between the colloquial usage of the word theory and the scientific use of the word theory. And it doesn't mean the same thing. It's not even close to meaning the same thing. And it's a point of confusion. And a lot of people who are not scientists don't understand the distinction. So this is something that I need to bring up. In colloquial usage, the word theory is used to mean just about everything. And it usually, the definition of the colloquial usage means, well, it's a guess. I'm just going to read something here that I found online to describe this. It does it a bit better than I do. So this comes from a physics website. In popular usage, a theory is just a vague and fuzzy sort of fact, and a hypothesis is often used as a fancy synonym to guess. But to a scientist, a theory is a conceptual framework that explains existing observations and predicts new ones. For instance, suppose you see the sunrise. This is an existing observation, which is explained by the theory of gravity proposed by Newton. This theory, in addition to explaining why we see the sun move across the sky, also explains many other phenomena, such as the path followed by the sun as it moves, as seen from Earth, across the sky, the phases of the moon, the phases of Venus, the tides, just to mention a few. You can today make a calculation and predict the position of the sun, the phases of the moon and Venus, the hour of maximal tide, all 200 years from now. The same theory is used to guide spacecraft all over the solar system. A hypothesis is a working assumption. Typically, a scientist devises a hypothesis and then sees if it holds water by testing it against available data obtained from previous experiments and observations. If the hypothesis does hold water, the scientist declares it to be a theory. So there's a very distinct difference between the colloquial use of the word theory and the scientific use of the word. And that's an important, very important distinction to make, and we'll be coming to that again and again and again in this discussion. So as you can see, a theory isn't just a wild guess. And that is actually one of the arguments that creationists often use against people who believe in evolution. They say, well, a theory is just a guess. But as you can see, it's not. In order to become a theory, you have to have a robust body of data, and it is testable and disprovable. And additionally, all of this data needs to fit within your theoretical framework. Now, I want to talk about religion here for a minute, because when I talk about religion, and I am talking about Christianity, I admit, but not all religion is the same. There are different ways of looking at things within the context of a religion. When I'm talking about Noah here, and when I'm talking about creationism and so forth in the context of this and future discussions, it's not a blanket statement that applies to all Christians. Obviously, not all Christians believe the same thing. That's why there are denominations. But my discussions are going to apply mostly to biblical literalists who believe that the earth was created in 6 literal 24-hour days, about 6,000 years ago. And I understand that there are a lot of Christians out there who aren't this rigid in their beliefs. And I think my friend Nick is a good example. Nick believes in creation, but he also acknowledges evolution. This is what I would call a theistic evolutionist. He thinks that God created the universe about 4 billion years ago, and that life on Earth was created by God using evolution to do it over a period of millions of years. Now, that's a lot more difficult to disprove, because that would involve disproving the existence of God completely. And that's not something that anyone can do, because, you know, there's no evidence of God, so therefore you can't go and disprove it. The fact that there is no evidence of God is a problem for that hypothesis, but it's not something that I can disprove in a half-hour show, and I'm not going to try. The Catholic Church recognizes evolution now. And that's another thing that I know that I've heard some fundamentalist preachers talking about that. And it's no secret that the fundamentalists hold Catholics in complete disdain as certainly not Christian and almost demonic, and a lot of them actually think that the Catholic Church is the whore of Babylon, spoken of in the Book of Revelation. But even the Pope acknowledges evolution. And this was the previous Pope, who was, if anything, more conservative than the current Pope. So there actually, I think, is a growing number of Christians out there who believe in this idea of theistic evolution. And this show is not directed towards them. And yeah, because they're not the ones who are believing crazy things. You know, it's not provable, of course, and it's not testable. Therefore, it's not science. But what they believe is a lot more reasonable than somebody who believes that the world was created 6,000 years ago in less than a week. But I'll tell you, back when I was a Christian, back in the 70s and 80s, this sort of belief would not have been accepted. Theistic evolutionists were every bit as demonic and satanic as, you know, the real evolutionists. So I see some progress happening here. Interestingly enough, there is progress happening in the fundamentalist world. So you'll notice that during the course of the show, I really haven't talked about Noah much. Well, that is deliberate. I will be talking far more about Noah next episode as I go into more specifics. But I did just want to try to cover some general points in this show. So anyway, how would a flood story start? Well, we know how mythology starts. It's an attempt by people who don't have advanced knowledge to explain phenomena in their world. The sun moving across the sky becomes a dung beetle pushing it across the sky, or Apollo towing it with his chariot. It really sort of depends on the culture that you're discussing. So how would a flood myth come to be? Well, obviously, most of the early civilizations of the Middle East and therefore sort of our own civilization started in river valleys, rivers that flooded every year. And so they would have been familiar with this concept of the river overflowing its banks and everything getting flooded. The Egyptians, the Sumerians, the Assyrians, anybody in the Mesopotamian region, and many other parts of the world as well. Another observation that they would have made is that sometimes when they go to the top of a mountain or very high hills, they would find seashells. Now, why would that be? Well, an ancient person, though they're not stupid, and I've talked about that in previous episode as well, they're going to think to themselves, well, how did this get here? They don't think to themselves, well, gosh, you know, this used to be the ocean floor, and it, by process of plate tectonics, they got pushed upward into a mountain range. They don't think that way. They think, oh my gosh, the water got really high. And this is where flood myths come from. So it's just a way of explaining this phenomenon. Now, they would regard this as a very realistic idea because they don't know any better. They don't have the knowledge that we have of things like plate tectonics. Okay, so I just want to talk about plate tectonics for just a second because it is important when we discuss Noah in the next show. Basically, plate tectonics is a fairly young science. It's only been widely accepted since the 1960s. And plate tectonics holds that the Earth's crust is divided up into different plates and that these plates move around. They don't move around very quickly, only a few centimeters a year. But you can see, anybody can look at a world map and see that the east coast of South America and the west coast of Africa fit together like a giant puzzle. And there are other parts of the world where you can see this as well. There are places where the plates are driven apart from each other. And the most notable of these is the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. The Atlantic Ocean is getting a few centimeters wider every year. And then where the plates strike each other, well, a couple things can happen. Either the plates can collide, and what happens then is it creates an upthrust of rock, and that creates mountain ranges. And this is, of course, observable. One of the best examples of this is the two plates colliding, the plate that most of Asia is on and the plate that the Indian subcontinent is on. And these two plates have collided and an upthrust has occurred, which has created the Himalayan Mountains. Now, we know also that the Himalayan Mountains are growing. They are getting higher because the plates are continuing to move towards each other. Now, eventually, you find that the plates do slow down or stop. in these cases. And a good example of that is the Appalachian Mountains, where Joe Morris lives. And that is two plates that collided many, many millions of years ago and now have stopped moving, and the mountains are eroding away. Now, the Rockies are a somewhat newer mountain range, and, you know, it's a similar story there. The other thing that can happen when two plates come together to collide is that one can go below another. And there are some very good examples of that, and the most notable one that I can think of is the west coast of the United States. We have two plates colliding here. When that happens, it is known as a subduction zone. And one plate is actually being forced down underneath the other. When you have this happen, the two plates rub against each other and friction is created. What happens when two things rub together and they create friction? Well, it gains heat and it creates earthquakes. It creates earthquakes and it creates volcanoes. And this is happening all along the Pacific Rim, which is sometimes referred to as the Ring of Fire, not to be confused with the Ring of Fire that Johnny Cash sang about. And this includes, you know, Japan with its earthquakes and volcanoes, California with its earthquakes, the Pacific Northwest with its earthquakes and volcanoes, all around the Aleutian Islands and Alaska and so forth. This is all part of the same system. So plate tectonics are pretty well understood. We have a pretty good idea of how it all fits together. We have a pretty good idea of the effects that plate tectonics has. And it seems to be a very robust theory in the amount of data that we're looking at. Himalayas are getting higher. We have subduction zones and so forth. That all fits in with that framework of the plate tectonics theory. In order to believe in the literal account in Genesis, you kind of have to throw plate tectonics out the window, along with a lot of other aspects of science, including DNA, cosmology, etc. All of that gets thrown out the window. Now, so what is creationism? Let's talk about that for a second, and I'm just going to wrap up the show talking about this. Creation science is also very new. It's only been around since the 1950s or so. And it is the notion that the biblical account of Genesis is the truth. Literally the truth. The earth was created more or less as it is about 6,000 years ago. The major proponents of creation science are groups like the Institute for Creation Research, I will be calling them ICR, Answers in Genesis, and a number of other groups. Some of the personalities involved are people like Ken Ham, Carl Baugh, Dwayne Gish, Kent Hovind, Henry Morris. There's any number of people. Now, the first thing you need to understand about these folks is that they're not scientists. Some of them have PhDs in divinity. Some of them are people who used to teach science in high school. In other words, they don't have a lot of scientific credentials. Many of them have degrees from these Christian diploma mills, which is a sort of a fraudulent school that doesn't really teach you anything, and you write them a 12-page paper and they give you a PhD, that sort of thing. A lot of them have this sort of degree. And a little bit of research, and I would encourage everybody to go out and do your own research on this and look into the credentials of some of these people. The other thing is they don't actually do any science. They don't gather data. They don't formulate a hypothesis. They don't create theories. In other words, they don't do science. And that's precisely my point. And with that, I'm going to draw the show to a close. Thank you for tuning in. If you want to contact me, it's very easy to do so. You can just email me, tom@tomharrisusa.com is the email address for the show. Or you can leave a comment on our Facebook group, which is the Tom Harris USA podcast community, and I'd be happy to hear from you there. Or you can even leave a message on the website, and each episode has a place for comments. Just click on the comments link and leave a comment, and I'll have to moderate that, but I haven't stopped anything yet. So feel free to contact us. If you agree with me, do you disagree with me, do you have something to offer, something additional, please feel free to contact the show. I love hearing from people. Anyhow, I'm going to sign off now. Thanks for listening. This is Tom Harris, Tom Harris USA, signing off. We'll see you next time.